I think we can start. Thanks for finding your way back from lunch. We had two, I'm hearing, very, very interesting sessions on the politics and public administration and on the economic policy. We're shifting our focus just slightly to social policy in this panel. I think the issues we're going to cover extend beyond social policy narrowly defined, and they touch again upon issues of reform, modernization, and in some respects at least to the economy. So we may have the opportunity during the discussion to go back to points that were raised in the previous sessions as well. I have to start with an apology. Professor Elias Moschelos cannot make it in this panel today, sends his apologies, but we're compensated. We have two excellent speakers with a great specialization on the topic who are going to talk to us exactly on issues of social policy and on the gender dimension of social policy, Platon Tinios and Antigone Liberaki. I'm not going to do the usual introductions on the bios. You have the booklets in front of you. And you know the details, I think everybody, they're known to everybody here in the audience. Without further ado, we start with the presentation by Platon.
Many thanks. So, better lunch than coffee. So, this is a little nostalgic because there's this book that came out in late October 1995, and which I would remind you of the political context that was in line at the same time. Incidentally, it's the same book that contained that contains still Kostas Simitis's present talk at the LSE in 1994, which was alluded to earlier. So it's definitely a very good read. I read it again, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. We could have stopped there. And in a sense, this is the problem, that much of what was said then is still as valid as it is now. So is it better late than never? In the case of social policy, which I think is interesting because it's a specific example of the general points that were made in the previous presentations. So we can actually focus our minds. We all know what the Greek pension system is like. So it's a sort of reform that, one, you can see how the general points actually relate to specific things. Now, this particular speech was made by Kostas Simitis on 19 October 1995, and it came just at the time when the Minister Simitis had just lost his post. He was had just returned to the back benches. It was the last policy statement before the succession battle started in PASOK. And up to that point, modernization was under fire in Greece as a technocratic stream of thought which lacked the social dimension. So it was concerned with matters of the elite, with experts, competitiveness, technology, European policy. And social policy was seen then as the Achilles heel and the comparative advantage of the old guard who showed their social conscience in every possible way. So the speech at the time appeared as a kind of attack on the economic orthodoxy, exemplified by the Ministry of Finance. Minister of Finance at the time was Yanis Papandoniou, and it argued against the position that social policy can only redistribute the fruits of growth. It argued that social policy can actually be incorporated into economic policy in a much more active way. And it had its political functionality in allowing many in the left and the trade union movement to sign on to the modernization movement as the new thing, as the new boy on the block, the stream of thought that actually had something new to say at the time. Now, what did it say? I think the key point was that social policy was not seen independently of economic policy. And independently of the modernization process, it was integrated into the whole. And it said that social policy and social protection should be constituent parts of the growth process and not rewards of its success. So they should be instruments of change, and not simply its rewards. The key function was to overcome the alliance of losers, and in order to allow change to go ahead. And hence, it wasn't a simple add-on. That speech had a critique of the existing situation, that i.e. social policy as a mechanism for building networks of clients, patronage. And it was an important part of the ideas there, that left the real social protection to depend on the family or the informal networks. Because as the state was concerned to give out privileges, then the real work, insofar as it had to be done by somebody else, and the family was the only one to take up the slack. And then social policy as luxury, that was a context at the time that Greece was leaving stabilization. And it says, if you see social policy as a luxury that comes after growth, then social policy becomes the first victim of stabilization and retrenchment. So the key motivating notion of the speech, which is how it started, is that the dilemma stabilization or an increase in pensions is a false dilemma. And that was a dilemma which was forced by a non-rational structure of expenditure, and hence the structure of expenditure had to change in order to be able to escape from the clutches of this dilemma. Now, but also had positive proposals, so it stated very clearly the need for a social safety net, which can provide a springboard for growth, and the need for actions tailored to growth, such as retraining youth unemployment. And finally, a need for evidence-based governance, which had to be concerned to discern the real cases of need and target it directly rather than just using need as an excuse to distribute benefits all around. The stream of ideas were actually a mirror of European developments which characterized the whole of the 90s. And those were the idea of the social protection that as a means of production. This was used in the European Union as a kind of answer to the pessimism that was current in the early 90s, that non-wage costs necessarily involve a loss in competitiveness. So it was the comparing the European Union with transatlantic and Pacific competitors and saying that with a generous welfare state, you can't compete. The counter example to that were Finland and Sweden, who managed to have both competitiveness and high social protection. So the question is, how do you get there? And the answer was to have social protection as a means of production, which was an idea was generalized in the Lisbon method of coordination, and became a pillar of the third way. In fact, you can see Tony Giddens arguing very much this point there, as he's waving his arms around as he did. And now it's now currently repackaged as the idea of social investment. Now, the second mirror was a recalibration of the familiar welfare state as a project specifically for Southern Europe. Maurizio Ferreira mentioned this, that this was a movement which was in all the southern European states, and the idea was that developments in the family and in social relations meant that the women particularly could not carry on to supply the kind of services that they used to in the context of the family, and the state had to step in and take over some of these informal welfare functions. And that meant that the Mediterranean welfare state had to adjust. It had to put less emphasis on pensions in order to free up fiscal space for the other benefits. And also, it needed to have more support for women who needed to be liberated from the family in order to be able to play a more active economic role. And finally, it was understood, and it's also evident in the state, that the first decisive step has to be a reform of pensions. That was motivated by the looming problems of demography on the one hand, but also new social structures, such as the prevalence of divorce, broken families, etc., and labor market development. So there were those three things that the social policy project foreshadowed much of the discussion that was to take place in Europe later on. And there was some very early progress. There was ECAS as a novel benefit. ECAS is a targeted pension benefit, which was introduced. Nikos Sotoulakis remembers very much, very well, how it was introduced and who objected in the first 6 months of the new administration. And that gave a sign of determination, 1996. It could serve as an illustration of the new approach because it diffused the pressure for generalized pension increases while at the same time giving quite unexpectedly large support to the people who could demonstrate real need. At the same time, it also used evidence. It used an intelligent approach, the tax data, to approach the question of who needs most. And it also delivered help in a timely and non-bureaucratic way. Similarly, in 1997, two major debates were started in tandem, independently. There was, on the one hand, pensions, and secondly, labor market flexibility. And in fact, Kostas Simitis shocked many people in Greece by talking openly of an employable youth, using the idea of that the ideal is someone who can adjust to the world rather than the world adjusting to him. And this employable youth was supposedly able to change direction, and this should be the aim of policy to allow this to happen. This reminded a lot of people of flexicurity, which means it's protection for the person rather than the job. Now, moving to the next seat, the Sprouse report in October 97 argued very forcefully the need for pension reform and outlined, no more than outlined, this is important, key decisions necessary for long-term growth. And the idea of the series of Sprouse reports, not just pension, should have prepared the ground for a more thoroughgoing change. However, the shocked reaction of public opinion forced a rethink to the report and the ideas contained in the report, and a change of pace. So the report was unfortunately very quickly swept under the carpet and suppressed. The labor discussion led to some very rather anodyne changes in labor protection and the postponement of the pension reform until after the elections of 2000. After 1998, I think, which is the watershed, social protection reform did happen, but it was happening in disappointing installments, despite a rhetorical persistence. The Yanitsis reform was withdrawn, and pensions after that could not allow, the fact that more and more money had to be absorbed by pensions could not allow the finance for new programs. So what I will give you is one macro and one micro example to show what this meant in concrete terms. Now, the macro story, which we see in total social expenditure increases, is that there was an increase in expenditure overall. And the fact that total expenditure was close to the EU average, EU 15 at the time, average and rising, was used in a traditional way as a proof of good intentions, even if the outcomes were no better. So more money was being poured to the problem, and that showed that the social conscience was there. Interestingly, if you compare it with the other bailout countries, Portugal, Cyprus, and Ireland, you can say that Greece in general spent when it could, and Ireland when it should, when it must have. We see, if we look at the specific case of means testing, there was the first step of ECAS, which increased it slightly, The attempt by Nikos Sotoudakis to extend means testing faltered in the courts and was withdrawn. Now, if we look at the structure, we see that social protection in Europe per capita increased, but the structure stayed more or less the same. And that meant that, you know, the money kept being poured into the social sector, but it had very little effect in limiting poverty because the structure of expenditure was such that it was primarily going to people who were well above the poverty level. So after a point, things more or less continued as they were. Now, a micro story, which is quite interesting, is the case of long-term care and the program Help at Home, the Voithias to Spiti. Now, that should have been the sort of thing that, given the overall strategic statement on social policy, should have been greatly encouraged and should have been accorded top priority. What used to happen, and what still happens, is that it's provided in some patchy residential care homes, old-age homes. The care was subsidized in a minority, but not all, pension funds. And people who were needing care were very frequently, and are still very frequently, parked in hospitals at far greater cost than they would have in if they were to stay in care facilities. Now, the Help at Home program was designed to plug the gap, and delivery was assigned to municipalities. However, most of the municipalities were completely reluctant to take it. They never treated this providing direct services as their own responsibility. They saw their own workers lying in other areas, and they saw this as an imposition on the part of the state. They did it very half-heartedly and very reluctantly, with very few exceptions. Now, finance, because of the pensions problems, was unavailable on any scale that would be commensurate with needs. It was financed as a pilot basis by the structural funds. The idea was that, you know, the voters will see that the municipalities are finally delivering something which is of value to the citizen, and hence that would encourage municipalities to take it seriously. It never happened this way. They would carry on complaining, and as no finance was forthcoming, the definition of what long-term care was kept changing. So, for example, in order to carry on being financed by structural funds, it was relaunched in 2006 as a employment protection of the people providing the care, and not the people receiving it. And even that was insufficient because the period ran out, and then it was relaunched again as a pensioners' help at home in order to tap the pension funds, which were thought to have a lot of money. In the meantime, while all this was going on, the care supplied was tiny. And as before, the family and the social networks had to do most of the work, or pass it on to the unregulated private sector. And the people who actually, in the end, supplied the long-term care that was needed, which, due to demographics, were rising all the time, was the unregulated private sector supplied by female migrants, mainly from the Balkans and the Ukraine. So the overall, we can see in both cases, both the macro and the micro, the overall social project in practice was abandoned. And social, there was some changes, and social policy more or less operated as before. That meant that in the outset of the crisis, the kinds of things that were warned against when the social policy agenda was launched happened to take place. There was, in fact, an anecdote that Yanis Spraus will remember, is that when the Spraus report on pensions came out, people were shocked to say, gosh, we're going to have to, because the report said that if you don't take any measures, things will start, due to demography, things will start getting very serious in 2007. We'll be close to bankruptcy of the pension system. And in order to calm reactions, the leader of the trade unions, Paulos Zoropoulos, came out and said, Sprouse is completely wrong because the state will go bankrupt before the pension system does. Unfortunately, he was right. One of the few cases where trade unions have their projections are spot on. So, and what happened? What were those things that had been warned against? Firstly, the pension system was unreformed. Pension expenditure was rising fast. It was rising fast both as a result of demographic change, because there is an undercurrent of demographic change as the Greek baby boom is retiring. And at the same time, of course, the governments of after 2004 did their best to make the system worse by granting pension increases, especially after 2008. As a result, pensions were responsible for a large part of the government deficit, and what was happening in pensions meant that nothing much could happen in the other parts of the social protection. Secondly, the social safety net was non-existent, because rather than building a social safety net as the Irish had done, or the Cypriots, in fact, the surplus had been distributed to pensioners. And as a result, the social safety net was still in the hands of the family, and which meant very little help for the newly unemployed. And the crisis led to a wave of early retirement, because that seemed to be the only instrument available. Finally, the social services, as we said, were completely inadequate to needs. And as the programs such as Help at Home were not entrenched, they didn't have people pressing for their continuance, they tended to become easier targets in the case of retrenchment. So everything was ripe to fall back to the family when funds were scarce, and the only will show you what happened in the case of women who had to live. So the imperative of social protection reform returns, and the bailout programs could not do other than take over the agenda of modernization where that had been left off willy-nilly. So they had to do this in a severe fiscal crisis, under a very pressing timetable, and under an inability to shift any costs forward, because any social security reform generates, even the ones that contain expenditure, generates temporary expenditure which needs to be spread out. No spreading out was possible. And all this was presented due to outside pressure, as we heard, and no. So what we had is what you heard before, is that you had reforms under duress, under the better late than never. So the first bailout in 2010 restarted the stalled reform. They moved in three directions, a drastic pension reform in two phases. This was accompanied by building a social safety net to begin in September 2010, and labor flexibility to deal with insider-outside dichotomy, and which was to deal with the entry into the labor force and with the insiders-outsiders. Now, the third bailout, 6 years later, is still attempting to do the same things. So exactly the three, a new pension law, retrospectively applies the 2010 system to all new pensioners, and early retirement has been blocked for those who failed to retire before mid-2015. In some cases, increasing retirement ages in one step by 17 years. And existing pensioners face repeated pension cuts to be reviewed and possibly extended in 2018. A guaranteed minimum income is to finally go ahead in 2017, we are told, though finance for it is still unclear. And repeated labor changes appear to have very little effect. So there is the reforming the labor markets is a little bit like First World War trench warfare. You each wave of reform manages to get one line of trenches, only to discover there's a second line of trenches behind it. So you collect all the political costs of reforming, but never seem to be able to reap any benefits on the reforms. So, nevertheless, as George Pagoulatos showed, the reforms did take place. And has this taken us where we should have been all along? So has the modernization project finally been realized by the Troika? Possibly. However, there's two key differences, and I'd like to dwell on this. Firstly, there was no time to plan, so only existing ideas and ready-made solutions were imported, and there was no time to justify. So there were ideology was left aside, and changes were introduced on a piecemeal basis on purely technocratic terms. Now, we see two examples, no time to plan. In the case of pensions, what that meant is that we're essentially solved last year's exam question. Now, pension reforms went to three phases. To begin with was the question of how to set up the pension system, how to make sure that there is an end to old age poverty. This was succeeded by concern for population aging, and now people are talking about how to accommodate the gig economy, the Uberization of labor, and how to contain, how to provide social protection in a very insecure labor force. Now, the third question is completely unknown in Greece. The second question has begun to be introduced, but the reform that was promoted really was only dealing with the first question. So the new problems were approached as if there were versions of the old. For example, this gig economy, it places major challenge for competitiveness and demands rethinking of the extent of and the type of social protection. What we did in 2016 and treated all members of the gig economy, the people who are known as working with blokakia, as if they were normal employees. And hence, their non-wage costs are increased by 28%. Second point is that pensions remain defined benefit, and pension promises hypothecate production far in the future in the same way that debt does. And thirdly, all the reforms were done on a kind of ceteris paribus way, though they were done piecemeal. And each reform presumes that the world remains as it was, and changes that are introduced are seen as kind of independent fixes, technological fixes. That means that you miss the structural imperatives. The big story is completely missed. And so things such as changes in people's aspirations, the way people live their lives, families, and so on, are missed. And the reforms are seen as separate, independent parts. The third thing is that no time to justify, and the costs, that there was no attempt to produce an ideological justification for the reform, and hence there was no ownership of the system, there was no answer to what social function the reform should serve. The danger that arises is throwing the baby out with the bathwater. For example, we do a lot of changes, supposedly to secure the sustainability of the pension system, but forget that the basic reason for having a pension system in the first place is that it should provide income security. So if you are never sure what your pension next year is, just there's no point of having a pension system in the first place. So, in other words, the design feature of the modernization project, where social protection fits into an overall idea, an overall societal transformation, is forgotten or missing. So, and this is my last slide, do we need a modernization 2.0? Now, what happened in the 1990s, modernization, with a capital M, answered the need for a new narrative in order to answer the question that was there, is to orient the exit from what in the early 90s was a very deep and deeply divisive stabilization program. The modernization project at the time involved a new social protection structure as key elements of an overall strategy. The crisis forced the kind of adjustment that should have happened with interest and introduced many parts of the modernization project. However, it did it in a way, in a technocratic way, which presumed that the world had stayed still, did not answer the new questions, and did not provide the narrative, did not show or discuss how social protection would fit into an overall transformation project. So the need for modernization 2.0 is precisely this, to do exactly the same job that modernization did 20 years on. Thank you very much.
Martin, I think it was a wonderful review of the reforms and non-reforms, and ending with something to reflect on whether it is possible to move to modernization to having partly missed modernization one. Antigone Liberaki now will talk again on the issue of social policy non-reform, but with attention to the gender dimension of it.
Okay. I'm very happy and very honored to speak today in front of you and be invited in this event. I chose a topic that raises eyebrows. Did modernization have a gender agenda? Should modernization have a gender agenda? Was gender something that somehow developed regardless of what politicians do? I'm going to argue that this the last 40 years, because, of course, I'm going to focus more on the period after 1996, but when gender issues are concerned, it's better to start from the mid-70s, because this is when the whole policy activity regarding the Constitution and the modernization of the various legislation and the family law and rights and stuff were first introduced. So if we look at it, it's basically 40 years of very substantial, important changes in the lives of people, men and women. The gender issues have gender policies and gender discussions were never haunted by this, timidity that followed pensions reforms, that people were in favor of reforming the pension system but were very shy to say it because they would be immediately characterized as, horrible blood-drinking neoliberals and whatever. On the contrary, talking about gender equality was always a good thing in Greece, and especially so in the period before modernization. Okay, so what I'm going to say is that regardless of policy activism, regardless of policy rhetoric, the question of the success of changing people's lives can be judged only by its results. So I'm going to try and see what happened to men and women over these past four decades. And in order to illustrate the changes that happened, because lots of changes both in gender policy but also in social policies happened during that time, I'm going to use the example of a hypothetical female, Ariadne, who was born in 1961 and who somehow saw all her life develop under these policies. So, first, I'm gonna say very, very briefly that modernization does not come in our minds as a period where politicians talked about gender equality. It comes to our minds as a period where politicians talk about opportunities, empowering individuals, giving the option to people to decide about their lives, but nothing specific on gender. And in a sense, one could say that because modernization was a kind of revolt against empty rhetoric of the previous phase, it could be understandable not to press rhetorically the point a lot, but one would still expect that modernization would be an ally to the gender equality project. So my argument is that it was not very easy to combine silence on gender issues and vocal stance in issues concerning opportunities, empowerment, employability, people taking the risk of changing their lives and changing their careers, because this is how economies and societies are actually solved from the pressures they face from globalization. It is a contradiction that has been imprinted in many occasions in a traumatic way in the lives of the people involved. So, looking back, what happened to women and men during this period? I should say, first of all, that in order to be fair, we need to consider initial conditions, because we're not discussing what happened over the past 40 years in Sweden, for instance. We're talking about what happened to gender and women in a society in which, in the early 80s, only 3 out of 10 working people were women, and basically, only 2 were working for some wage, because the 3rd was an unpaid family member. So this is the starting point, which definitely plays a role. So also, when we look again what's happening now to the people who entered the labor market in the 80s, these are the people who are now into retirement. And so the picture of the retirees reflects these earlier conditions. And so it's not a surprise that women's pensions are lagging behind men's pensions. The gender gap in pensions is more than twice as wide as the gender gap in wages. And the idea is that, to a large extent, gender policy in Greece is about derived rights. Women derive rights from their other activities and not basically from their own work. I just wanted to show you this graph because it is probably the most optimistic, the best news I can think of. It shows the massive increase of women into the labor force and the very clear decline of unpaid family labor members who are represented in the lower part of the panel. So you can see that the number of women in paid jobs more than doubled over the period. And at the same time, there were some important changes in social policy, which, however, happened in a context where working people were divided into a very rigid two-set world. On the one hand, the insiders, who enjoyed a lot of protection, And on the other side, the outsiders who enjoyed much less protection and were facing more uncertainties. I'm not going to try and say that women should be included in the outsiders, because this is not correct. In fact, women were overrepresented within the insiders. Out of every four working women, one is a public sector employee, and three work for the private economy. This ratio is much higher than what happens to men, and it's much higher than what happens elsewhere also. But interestingly, regardless of whether women were insiders or outsiders, there were some crucial missing links, missing, how shall I say, missing policies in the social protection system. The first was that there was the substitution of care activities by the state or the market or the combination of the two was always much lower than the amount of care that was required, both for childcare and for elderly care. In addition, there was no considerable or significant social safety net, which means that people did not have any real support if and when they decided to make career breaks or take high-risk decisions concerning their future moves into the labor market. In terms of gender and social policy, there has always been this implicit argument. Because social protection could not take over the care work and the rest of what is considered to be a woman's job in the family, so the social policy and even employment policy should overcompensate by offering highly protected conditions for women, which means that their length of working life was expected to be shorter. The demands that their job was making on them were supposed to be less, acute. And finally, the idea was that since the state does not develop what is needed for gender equality, let's protect and treat women as passive agents, not as active agents, who need to be told how much and how intensively they're going to work. And interestingly, this discourse was equally forcibly proclaimed by feminists, i.e. friends of the women's movement, and by traditionalists, who thought that let's not demolish the family and the functions that the family rests on. So I just wanted to show you this, because this shows very clearly that the progress in women employment was very much a public sector-led progress. The pink bars show you the increase in women's employment in the public sector. The others are men and women, public-private. But clearly, the increase, part of the increase of women's employment, it was due to the public sector. So let's move to Ariadne. I wanted to discuss how these decades worked for a female, a middle-class female, who studied and started to work in the 80s, lived her prime working age in the 90s, and was caught by the crisis in her mid-50s. I'm doing this not because I'm a feminist and I think that personal is political, but on the contrary, because I am a feminist, but the argument is contrary to that, that every political project needs to have some story that translates into how people live their lives and how it makes a difference one way or another. So in that sense, I want to introduce you Ariadne, who would have supported modernization at each and every phase, who thought she took the right decisions. She participated in the pre-crisis prosperity, and she also participated very painfully during the crisis years. In the 80s, Ariadne was preparing for university. Her parents had a small family business. They were producing garments. It was an old family business. I mean, her parents got it from their own parents. And Ariadne believes that she needs to study because she wants a career on her own. She doesn't want to be her father's daughter and work in the family business. She doesn't want to study, the typical female subjects. She goes to study economics. Of course, she has to go through 2 very expensive years of private tuition, Fraudisterio plus Ideatera. Of course, she manages to enter the university, but in a different town, so her family not only paid for her, preparation to enter the university, but also they had to pay for the 5 years, because at the time, people who finished at 4 years were thought to be stupid and not interested in real life and real issues. So Ariadne, of course, could not finish like a Fitoukla in 4 years. She had to extend it for at least a year. And after that, her family supported her to make a 1-year master course in the UK to supplement her studies. So Ariadne is a very active agent of the new modernization world. When she comes back home, she decides to find a job, but then her uncle, who works at the National Bank, tells her, we have some openings for family members. And she said, okay, let's go to the National Bank. Her significant other, who was a co-student of her, also gets a job, and they start by getting the same salary exactly. She decides to get married, and she feels top of the world. She thinks that she has done the right thing to proceed in life. Let's move a bit further. Where gathering clouds are becoming felt, because Ariadne pursues her career, but she also has 2 children, and she needs also to find not only adequate kindergarten, but also people to substitute her hours at home. Her salary lags visibly behind her husband because in the meantime he moved to a private bank. There was this liberalization of the banking system that you probably remember after Karadzhas' report. So he got a much better paid job, and he's a high flyer. She feels stuck. She doesn't want to take extra responsibilities because she was thinking that she needs to be at home to influence the children. In the meantime, the family business has a major problem because imports in garments finally were liberalized in the 90s, so these people could not produce any longer, but they did not want to close it completely, so they switched into imports. They imported branded garments, lots of demand in Greece. But this whole situation makes her still dependent on her family because she wants to offer her children things that will make them true young Europeans, like traveling abroad, buying things for them. So she borrows money from her family. She's ready to get a divorce. And she sits and makes melancholy thoughts in their family house in an island, which was bought by a big loan from the bank that she is working. So this I'm showing you only to show you how, although in the beginning in the public sector and in the private sector, men and women get almost the same salaries, as time goes by and experience kicks in, there's a very big diversion. This is to explain to Ariadne why her husband gets much higher, her ex-husband now. So now let's move to the third phase, the perfect storm, what happens during the crisis. Ariadne sees her world completely crumble. This time, the family business goes bust. They had arrears, they had debts, they could not stand any longer. So she cannot get any help from there. The ex-husband continues to be very busy. She needs to support one child studying in Greece, another one abroad. Her mother is fragile. The taxes and bills and extraordinary levies pile up. What can she do? She goes back to live with her mother. So Ariadne closes her house, cut down expenses, goes back to her mother, making the full circle of independence, back to her mom, in order to be able to offer some care and also save some money for the children. She takes early retirement also. Why? Because she was not particularly happy with her job, because all her male colleagues somehow became much more important than herself. But also because she fears that if she waits out the recession, there will be no pension to get anyway. So she said, let's get the pension now, and I'm going to get a consultancy job. After all, I'm an economist. What can I do? The thing, however, is that now Ariadne feels not only a victim, but she feels that she's fooled. She is indignant, and she votes no in the July 2015 referendum because she feels that she needs to protest. Why does she feel that she needs to protest? Because she feels that the idea that if you make the right decisions and if you pursue what is expected from you, then you can have a winning life and career. This was not the case. And interestingly, the things that Ariadne, if she was here, would ask from Prime Minister Tsimitis to pursue, that is flexibility, the capacity to give assistance to people who wanted to change their careers, to open themselves to risky but probably with high rewards decisions. This kind of thing was always seen by Ariadne and her friends as the real enemy, because she was always expected to value security, stability, immobility, and protection, even paternalistic protection. So instead of having Ariadne and the women of her generation asking for more modernization and more difficult and upsetting measures in social policy that would really open up the terrain both for men and women to compete, Ariadne and her friends no longer believe in modernization. They definitely don't believe in equality, and they are ready to believe whoever promises the most passive and protective future to them. So I'm going to give you only this final slide, because Ariadne is named after the mythical Ariadne, whose story has many possible endings. We don't know how our Ariadne is going to behave in the near future, but we know that after Ariadne, the mythical Ariadne, offered Theseus the way out of the labyrinth due to her famous string, we know that Ariadne is abandoned on Naxos, although she was promised to become a queen. Okay. Now, Ariadne, the mythical Ariadne, was definitely betrayed. Now, there are three different versions. The one is that Ariadne commits suicide. Very, very obscure. The second is that she is murdered. Horrible, too. The third one, which is a more Pollyanna kind of, Barbara Cartland, rather, solution, is that she marries Dionysus, she has lots of sons, and she lives among the immortals with a very nice view in Mount Olympus. We don't know how our own Ariadne will find her way out of the crisis, but her dilemmas and her misgivings are very real, and the fact that they were not intended to happen does not mean that they are less real or important. Thank you very much.
I think we had two great presentations and opening up on many issues and with many nice presentational tricks, let's say. I want to open it up for questions, but I would like to sneak in my question first while you collect your thoughts, if I may. And it's almost the same question to both presenters. Platon was saying that essentially that pensions had to be kept high, the cost of pensions also meant that there was no available money for other social protection spending. And this reminded me what the finance minister, Professor Tsakalotos, said in a speech here at LSE some time ago, that we need the pensions because that's what keeps the social transfers alive. Yeah? So the pensions finance the unemployment benefit of the grandchildren. And I want to ask, was then in that story that you were describing a choice or a necessity? So was it politically convenient, as it seems to be in the more contemporary case? Was it politically convenient to keep the transfers from pensions to the grandchildren then, as it seems to be now? And a similar question about sort of the intention of all this, although I think you answered it, Antigone, at the very end. Whether that kind of second best argument to shorten the employment period of females, especially in the public sector, in order for them to be able to provide the social services, care services in the household and across households, actually, whether, again, that was intentional, was it convenient electorally or anything else, or was it some sort of path dependency, exogenous, that, you know, it just happened? So if you can perhaps keep this... questions. I don't know if you want to respond immediately, but I see a few hands, so collect some more questions then. Yeah, okay. First question here, and then...
Yeah. Thank you very much. Oh, it's on. Thanks. Question for both of you, I think. I think that from what I got, the main point in Platon's presentation was the need for a new narrative to support modernization too, and to make Ariadne rally behind the modernization effort, right? Especially now that she's in this huge crisis in her life, and Dionysus she has not proposed yet to her. Now, there are three questions related to that. One is, what kind of narrative would that be? But this is an easy question, don't bother to answer. There are two more difficult ones. First, who is to provide the narrative in the crisis? And second, is there a market for that? In other words, is there a real possibility that Ariadne will buy the narrative? Thanks.
Thanks.
Dimitris Papadimitriou from the University of Manchester. Thanks very much for both presentations. What I felt while I was listening to you, and I'm sure that a similar story would emerge from a discussion on healthcare, is really the centrality here of how interests in Greece are articulated and how they are then mediated to the government. Right? I mean, a lot of the stories that we hear is, you know, how do people understand their own interests, and how then interests of various groups of the population get transmitted to the government. And that, of course, makes me think of two things, which I fear were absolutely central in any modernization project. One is the trade union law. The other one is the electoral law. And listening to both of you, I cannot feel but thinking a little bit melancholic that even the most well-intentioned modernization project is idea feels to me like an excellent fuel that is put in a car without a gearbox.
Nice. If you want to respond to some of these questions, then we'll have another round.
I'll actually add another question from my side to you. Well, just hearing Ariadne's story and living in Greece, when you hear that modernization is blamed for almost everything, whereas in fact modernization with a capital M only accounted for a rather short period of time, but people feel very personally betrayed by modernization. They're ready to blame modernization much more than the other political movements who governed Greece for a longer time, and who can be proved to be, say, more responsible for what it was. But there is some reason that was certainly in nowadays that in the Syriza universe, the modernizers appear to be the real enemy. And there's a paradox in this. Now, as for the questions, whether it was a choice or a convenience, I think it was both, and I think Dimitris Papadimitriou's point explains why. It was just the way that things are discussed and the way the major questions are processed and relayed to public opinion. I think this more or less determines the outcome. For example, my example of Polizogopoulos and whether who would become bankrupt first, the state or the trade union movements, he was able...
The pension system.
Trade union movement is bankrupt anyway.
Yeah, right. Whether it was the pension system or the government, that meant that he understood the question, but he chose to avoid it, partly because he thought that the... He gave, of course, the wrong answer, but it was the right answer for his time frame. I mean, if he looks at things in a very short-term way. But when it became bankrupt, they say this carrying on the story, when it became bankrupt, he was rewarded with some very good jobs, even after becoming bankrupt. So in a way, that the system gives completely the wrong incentives, pushing people in the wrong direction. So there is something lacking in the technology of discussion in Greece, and the sort of discussion that we are having in this room here is something which is virtually unknown in Greece. And that creates a sort of path dependency which always leads to the wrong decisions. Now, Takis Papas, I think we are in a similar situation. I was very perplexed. But in the previous discussion, when none of the people speaking seemed to have an answer, whenever somebody came with a possible answer, such as Yoros Pavlatos, as he said, mentioned foreign direct investment, he himself immediately gave four or five reasons why no one should ever be interested to come and invest in Greece. And that leaves us in a kind of perplexity, where we can all see there is a blank wall ahead, but no one can provide us a way out. Now, in this way out, I mean, some people can provide ways out which don't exist, which is the populist way. We can make Greece great again, just to coin a phrase. or they can produce something which can actually hold. And modernization 2.0 is something that is a feasible narrative. And I think the situation in Greece is now is ripe for, and people are ready to listen to this narrative. The question is that the political system seems to prevent anything being shown in this direction. And what we're now seeing is rather facile stories of blaming everything, for example, on the particular people in government, and saying that hence a simple change of personnel would be able to solve all our problems. I mean, this was essentially the same argument that was used in 93 to go beyond the Mitsotakis government, and the people got into government without any idea what they were going to do with it. And I'm afraid we are more or less in the same position. So if somebody does have an idea, perhaps they can tell us, and we'll be behind them 100% of the way. Great.
Okay, I'll...
Aristocracy, then.
I feel that I'll give only partial answers, because you happen to ask the questions that, had I known the answer, I would probably be somewhere else now, near Platia Syntagmatos. But I don't. So, but let me try. I don't like to discuss a lot about intentions in politics, because I know very often that the unintended consequences of decisions can be much more important than the intentional outcome. So, and I also do not need the good or the bad heart of politicians to make my argument. I assume that everybody has good intentions, but simply some are more right than others. So I don't think that one needs to spend lots of time to, shed light into intentions. However, I can think of many reasons why the modernization governments in the late 90s were not very keen to touch gender equality issues, given the state of the debate that was dominating these issues in Greece. Regardless of whether the women's party section was the right, the left, the Synaspismos, or the PASOK, the EGE, they shared a common understanding of the women's issue, that is basically that women are victims, and if you are a friend of women, you need to unburden them by the extra burden that they carry. The idea of the individual effort, but this was also the case for the dominant ideology among men also. I mean, it was not only on the women's issues. The idea that individuals take decisions, gain, lose, try again, is completely missing. So I can think of reasons why modernization did not want to rock the boat of feminist debate and discourse in Greece. What I don't see, however, is how the empowerment of the individual aspect of modernization, which is central. If you don't have empowerment of the individual, then modernization has to go to the garbage. It has no other anything else to offer. I question whether you could have this kind of empowerment without empowering women. And unless you have a very specific gender empowerment agenda, this does not happen on its own. And this is why I used Ariadne's story, because the road to hell is paved with good intentions, and I think this is the case for Ariadne and also for her family and for most of us. Now, who provides narratives? I think that
all politicians provide narratives. The thing is that conventional politicians who do not want to change things but simply want to change the fact that they are outside the parliament and they want to be inside, the only change that they want is this, they don't need to question the narrative about how the world works, what is globalization, what are the opportunities, what are the constraints, what kind of reforms we have to take, what kind of investment. They don't need to. They just offer whatever it takes to get the magical number and enter parliament. But for politicians who want to change things, it is not conceivable of not having a narrative. And only narratives can win the hearts and minds of people. If you think of yourself in a different set of conditions, in a different world, it is the only way to have incentives to change. So I think that whenever politicians have narratives and credible narratives, people respond to them. And I'm very unhappy with what is usually the discussion among politicians. Okay, people do not really understand, so we're going to offer them the same stupid story that has always been the case in politics. People understand, but politicians have to work a little bit in order to increase their enhance their understanding.
Okay, we have a bit of time for another round. Can I have a question here, then in the front?
Thank you, Vasily. Both presentations, I think, were wide-ranging and very, very useful. I have very specific questions on economic and social policy, one for each. To Platon, could you comment on the insistence of the representatives of the lenders, what we used to call the Troika, to have the ECAS social allowance phased out? Because I have only heard that they do not agree with the non-contributory nature of this. And could you comment on this in conjunction with the attempts of the incumbent government, first in March 2015, to introduce the social package of solidarity that, as you know, included subsidies to rent, and the current ongoing attempt to introduce the social allowance of solidarity to be starting on the 1st of January 2017. Does all this add to something which escapes me? Is there a logic behind it? And is this something you want to explain to us? And Antigone, I suspect, first of all, Ariadne is a true person, but you don't need to go into details. The story is very concrete.
Not a relative of mine, although okay. I have a very big family.
But My question has to do with the fact that you actually underlined the fact that wage differentials started after a certain point in her career, although I remember you in other occasions arguing that the reasons for the gender gap in incomes are multiple and then one should take into account different access to education, different education tracks of men and women, and above all, differential access to labor markets, which is a set of arguments saying that the gender gap in incomes is more owed to the starting points rather than to the way careers have evolved if we compare men and women. Thank you.
Dimitri, can you pass it?
Yeah, I have a question which is mainly for Platon, and it has to do with modernization with a little M and with a capital M. Do you think there was any useful reform in Greece before modernization with a capital M, especially in pensions? And do you think that there is a chance of having a new wave of modernization 0.2, only from people who espouse modernization with a capital M.
And
yes, I It's an idea I have, but I want to you both to react if you want to that. It is that in social policy in general and in social policy with regard to gender issues, I think there is a pattern in policy making which has to do with concentrated costs, concentrated benefits and diffuse costs. Very often, what happens is that certain groups get a kind of advantageous position or conditions for pension, and that applies to women also with these early retirement conditions, without any concern about the diffuse costs that imposes on society. I think this applies to early retirement. This applies to sometimes very, I would say, advanced protection for, or not protection, also help to women who have children. They can have a leave of absence of practically 2 years, which is, I don't know if there's any other country paid for 2 years. It also applies to other areas which are outside of what we are talking today. For example, transfers of students who succeed in regional universities and they are transferred on certain social criteria to central universities. So I feel there is a pattern there in many different policy areas, which is that the state develops a social policy, but with no regard to the diffuse costs, which are real. Early retirement for women means a burden to the insurance funds. The same was with the privatization of public enterprises when they wanted to get rid of big numbers of personnel, and they passed it on the social security funds. So I feel that there is a pattern there. Would you like to comment?
Okay, thanks. If I may, we'll take another two questions that we have, and then you'll have time to quickly answer. We'll eat a bit into the coffee break, but we started late, so we are excused. So one question at the very end over there. Seven? Yep.
Robert McDonald from Oxford Analytica. My remarks are more in the course of an intervention. My intervention is more in the course of a comment. I think the fundamental issue in both presentations is politics. Let me say that we couldn't be sitting having this kind of discussion in Greece, and that's perfectly true, because everybody in the room would have a political point of view and would be arguing from that political point of view and not from the facts that underpinned it. And I think one of the things that stood out in my mind, you talked earlier in the day about Professor Sprouse's magnificent report on pension reform, and you'll perhaps recall that within weeks, ESA had produced a counterblast of wishy-washy information about pension reform, which was the most tendentious rubbish you could possibly imagine. Much as Zergopoulos was a nice man, he simply allowed this to get out into the public domain, and it made the movement rather risible. I would say, for Antigone, the problem with women's rights in many respects was politicized in the early 1980s by Margaret Papandreou's campaign. She was too aggressive. Mrs. Lau was too spacey. And if it had been left to somebody like Iligi Malarangu, who could have walked her way through the politics with her arguments and her knowledge of the system, maybe it would have worked. But in many respects, the women's movement was discredited in the early 80s in that first PASOK government, and it took it over a decade to recover.
Okay, thanks. Right. And the last question, and then we go back to the answers. Katerina.
Hi, Katerina Glinadaki from the Hellenic Observatory. I have a question for Professor Liberaki. So you mentioned in your talk that an opportunity and empowerment that comes with modernization cannot be combined with silence on gender issues. So we saw that modernization sort of went hand in hand with gender equality advancement, sort of, not exactly, not ideally. And we also talked about today a lot about how people in Greece are becoming skeptical at best, and they just turn against modernization as an idea at worst. And my question is, apart from my Ariadne, who we know was very discouraged through her journey and lost hope on gender equality, what happens in the case of the general public? Do they also lose hope, or is it too late and now sort of more gender egalitarian gender values have been ingrained in the way people think?
Okay, thanks. A range of questions. Antigone, would you like to start?
Okay.
And I remind you.
Okay, let me first respond to your question, Dimitris, about the gaps, the gender gaps in salaries. You heard me say that when in the economies where many women work, you have a large wage gap between men and women because when women work in large numbers, they also work in badly paid jobs. So the end balance usually is to have a wider gender wage gap, which is good news because it's the first step to move to greater equality. Now, the thing that I showed before was from a panel, the same people who were asked when they were 22, they were asked when they were 26, then they were asked when they were 30, 35. So you have the development of the salary of the same people as experience kicks in. And this shows that ensuring initial equal wages cannot ensure equal careers because women work much fewer hours, take much fewer positions of responsibility, and because they are very likely to retire early, they never get as much promoted as a man, or they don't attend seminars and stuff. So you cannot have an equality agenda without dealing with this. Now, Kalliopis's point about the visible winners and the invisible losers, and the fact that winners know who they are and they are very happy about it, and the losers do not know that they are losers and they are paying for this. I think that this is almost the definition of clientelistic politics. This is how clientelistic politics can exist in the first place, because the people who are who feel that they are granted favors know that, and they reciprocate by voting or supporting, whereas the rest do not know what is happening to them, and so the whole society moves backwards. I think that the opposite to that is general rules. And in Greece, I have the feeling that we are a bit skeptical vis-à-vis general rules, because we think, because we are used to having individualized solutions that will be given to us, and that this will not harm the rest of the people, because this is also another kind of myth, that we can be privileged without anybody paying for the bill. Mm-hmm. And I think there is throughout the decades that I have memories of, there is a resistance to applying generalized rules. Sometimes the resistance is people say that no generalized rules can be can address a very complex reality, as if generalized rules are only for simple situations, but especially in complex and complicated realities you need the generalized rules. But I think that the deepest reason is that you cannot exclude yourself from the application of generalized rules. So this is this. So I agree with you. It is a problem that has not been eradicated yet, and I doubt whether it will be. Now, trying to respond to Katerina's question about the general public, my argument was not that there is no hope for equality between women and men, and it was not also that there is no better life is possible. I happen to believe that both of them are possible. What I'm questioning, however, is to what extent you can put the legislation in place and then leave real life to solve the nitty-gritty of it. I think that values, ideas, expectations, and stereotypes, role models, act very powerfully. And although you can have an ideal legislation, they somehow dictate different behaviors to men and women. And unless you deal with that, you cannot empower individuals at all. So in order to, lighter tone, in the same way as you cannot address exploitation in the Marxist idea without liberating the working class, you cannot have liberal values and liberal opportunities and equal opportunities and empowered individuals unless you deal with gender discrimination. That's it.
Thanks. Platon.
The ideal social policy, I think, in Greece is the one practiced by Evita Peron. What she did is she held court in the presidential palace, and she had the governor of the central bank sitting next to her, and there was a queue of people. She running well into the early hours of the day, and people would come along, and they would set up. They will say what the problem was, and she would immediately give a command to the governor of the central bank to give out a check. Now this has she. Cashed it in, and she became a candidate for sainthood in the Catholic Church. Kostas Simitis is not yet. Now, this was the Catholic Church, of course. He was especially popular in the Orthodox Church, as we all know. Right. This, in a way, answers Dimitris's point about ECAS. ECAS was no more than a guaranteed minimum income, especially for pensioners, and the reason was that pensioners were the only group of the population that had an information base that on which it could be based. And the idea was that it should have been followed by an extension of the idea of judging need to cover all the population. What instead happened is that more and more people tried to get into the idea of ECAS. So rather which meant it militated against the whole point of ECAS, which was supposed to be a targeted benefit. After the crisis, what happened is that when incomes fell, the thresholds of ECAS remained the same, and as a result, more and more people were receiving ECAS. Now, it was very interesting to see the reaction of all governments to the idea of a generalized minimum income. Generalized minimum income, the whole point about it is generalized and it's impersonal. It works on the basis of rules and it's not up to negotiation. You can't have a side deal with that. So the first memorandum, there was a requirement in September 2010 that proposals of this should be started. That was completely ignored. And the Troika, in the third memorandum, what they essentially said is that something like ECAS should be generalized to the whole population, that pensioners should not be privileged over the entire population. Syriza was very resistant to this idea. They would prefer very much to have a social, their answer to the what they call the humanitarian crisis, which to have a rag bag of individually tailored benefits, each of which could be addressed to a particular section of the population and traded, presumably, for votes. Now, for George Alagoskoufis, of course, pension reform promoted by Stefanos Manos in 92 was extremely important. PASOK campaigned very vigorously against that, and the major achievement of the first couple of years of PASOK was not to repeal that law. I mean, they saw the contribution to solving the social security problem as not doing what they had promised to do. Now, whether the new boys can be brought in, there was a film that was made a couple of, about 10 years ago. It was directed by Clint Eastwood. And the idea is that various old age pensioners are brought in to save the world. Maybe we will, I don't know. Well, everybody knows our email, and we're ready. We're open to offers. Now, the last question about discussion, the state of discussion. It's in the state of discussion, I think, is the key to the solution of the problem, is that the state of discussion of issues in Greece is severely lacking. And I think academics, just to put it, academics have a very large portion of the blame. And that the kind of discussion, this sort of discussion could never take place in a Greek university. It never takes place.
And
because the academic career is such that us economists have produced clever mathematical models or maybe econometric solutions, or dealing with small problems that have definite answers. And also there is a lack of clear heads.
We're not aware of that, but I think...
Well, in a way, if... I think most... in my university, they all think that we're irrelevant anyway, so they wouldn't bother. Yeah. I mean, so maybe it's a good thing if they try. Yeah.
Okay, I think the last comment that's, you know, a lot of it is political and hardly ever factual, even when we talk about facts. I think it also connects to an earlier point that was made about how do you mobilize if there's demand for reforms and how do you create a narrative that will sort of support this demand. I'm sure we cannot hope that we will resolve these issues in this panel or even today, but let's take a coffee break and we'll resume in 25 minutes with our last panel. And let's thank the speakers.